This all started in museums and galleries. Now it's in classrooms, in country towns.
This should not be here.
It's a human being in a box.
This is the stuff of empires.
There is a great betrayal.
We're not slaves, we're African.
It's the stuff the British stole.
I just don't believe that. It just does not stand up.
From ABC Australia and CBC Podcasts, 6 brand new podcast episodes for free worldwide, available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Okay, so I don't know if you remember Prince Andrew's disastrous 2019 interview with the BBC. If you don't, that interview basically ended Prince Andrew's career as a royal. There's a new Netflix movie about how it all came together. It's called Scoop. Today on the podcast, revisiting a turning point for the royal family. I'm Alamin Abdul-Mahmoud, and this is Commotion. Look, at least in theory, interviews can be a powerful tool for the public figure trying to clear the name. That is probably what Prince Andrew was hoping for when he sat down with the BBC in 2019. It was supposed to give clarity about his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein, a convicted sex offender charged with sex trafficking, and also allegations that Prince Andrew was facing that he had sexually assaulted a 17-year-old, Virginia Joffrey. Instead, he was mocked and memed for the answers that he gave, like not regretting his friendship with Epstein because it led to opportunities that were, quote, actually very useful, or the part where he said Joffrey's allegations could not be true.
She described dancing with you and you profusely sweating and that she went on to have bath, possibly...
There's a slight problem with the sweating because I have a peculiar medical condition, which is that I don't sweat, or I didn't sweat at the time, and that was... Oh, actually, yes. I didn't sweat at the time because I had suffered what I would describe as an overdose of adrenaline in the Falklands War when I was shot at, and I simply... It was almost impossible for me to sweat.
So days after that BBC interview aired, Prince Andrew stepped away from royal duties and public life. Now, the story of how this interview came to be has been made into a movie. That movie is called Scoop. It is out right now on Netflix. Hannah Flint is a TV critic from the UK, and Ellie Hall is a longtime royal correspondent based in Washington, D.C. To set the stage for this conversation, Ellie started out by telling me how big of a deal this BBC interview was.
It's hard to overstate how instrumental this interview was in shaping the next, I'd say, 20, 25 years of the royal family. Oh, we're seeing it as a problem now because there was no way Andrew could continue in public life after this. He showed himself to be untrustworthy. He showed himself to be very full of himself. Mm. And it really, watching him give these answers, you really have to question like what the purpose of the monarchy is if it can produce someone with this level of cluelessness and entitlement. The Queen had to remove him from public life or else it would have been a danger to the monarchy. Like, people talk about the damage Harry and Meghan have done to the monarchy. That's nowhere close to Prince Andrew. And you notice he's still in the royal fold, but not just stepping back from royal life at this point, he eventually did settle his lawsuit with Virginia Joffrey. Mm-hmm. And that was when he finally was stripped of all of his titles. And yeah, this interview not only changed his life, but it really changed the way that the monarchy has to operate in terms of press coverage, you would think. This movie and everything that's recently happened with Kate Middleton, it really does drive home that the palace wasn't operating in the real world back then. Mm-hmm. And it still doesn't seem to have an idea of how to deal with the modern age. I mean, one thing that Scoop got right was that at the end of this interview, Andrew thought he did great. And Andrew thought like, hey, I've done a great job. I answered all these questions really well.
Yeah.
And you really get that sense in the movie. After the interview's over, you see all of the BBC people looking at each other like, oh my God, what's going on? And Andrew's like, oh, that went really well.
Hannah, do you remember watching that 2019 BBC interview? Like, do you remember having an impression of it when it first came out?
Oh, yeah. It confirmed everything I hate about the royal family.
Okay. Go on.
I think, you know, one of the good things about sometimes when you see these things is like seeing what Twitter has to say. And, you know, Pizza Express woking. I hope they're printing money now because I feel like people are just going to flock there just so they could take it. This is where he said he was, quote unquote.
Do you want to actually explain that? Because there was a moment where in the interview where he's like, I couldn't have been there because I was at this weird pizza joint. And so the reason I remember this is because he would have been weird for me to be at this pizza joint. So like this is in answer to one of the allegations. But sorry, continue.
Yeah, I think for me, it's one of those frustrating watches where obviously you're kind of seeing. I mean, one of the great things about it is like he's just basically showing you who you are. Like, if anyone wants to tell you who you are, believe them the first time. Is that the Maya Angelou quote?
Yeah.
So I think in a way that's good to see, but it's so interesting what you said about like, it's made such a big difference. And I think surely for Prince Andrew and maybe in like how media operates with the royal family, but like it's 2024 now, I can't really see much really shifting in like actual things that really matter about dismantling monarchy and really getting in stuff getting changed. I mean, if I'm wrong,
we're seeing it now. The only reason I said that is because right now we're at a position in a position where two senior royals are just out of commission for foreseeable
future.
Currently
unavailable
because they're both undergoing chemotherapy. That doesn't leave many royals around to do royal things. And especially, I think that if the king and Kate are out for a really long period of time, we're going to be seeing more and more people questioning the value of the monarchy, because what keeps them in the public eye is, you know, going out and opening hospitals and cutting ribbons and meeting these people. And if there's not even that little bit of civic interaction and public service that you see, I mean, you can't help but question. I
can only hope that's the case.
To go back to this movie, the movie is about how this interview came together. I want to play you guys a scene where a producer is making the case to Prince Andrew why he needs to sit down with the BBC. Listen to this.
You know how people see you, don't you?
Why don't you spell it out?
Brandy, Andy, Air Miles, Andy, this is sex and girls and planes and private islands and money. And with respect, the public see these stories and they think, yep, I can believe that. This isn't bad for your brand. This is your brand.
With respect? Well, so I've got a point.
Ellie, that scene was probably the most uncomfortable scene watching this, because there is like there's a dynamic where, you know, a royal is being confronted with how they're seen, and you're sort of meant to decode their reaction to it, and he does not appear to be comfortable in this moment. Did you learn anything new watching this movie? Any interesting details will pop out for you?
One thing that I didn't know, but it does make sense, is that a crisis management team had been brought in to try to help him rehabilitate his brand. And I don't mean to like go back to the Kate Middleton thing, but you know, PR people and crisis management people are only good if you listen to them and if you take their advice. And what was made very clear in this movie was that everyone just did everything that was contrary to a plan that could have maybe rehabilitated his image. So I found that to be very interesting, and I love the scene where he just walked in and said, you didn't set any limits on the interview. There are no limits.
No conditions at all. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, absolutely no conditions, and then he just walks out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would do that too.
That's it. I mean, like, this is, I think, what some of the stuff that I was really interested in, Hannah, when I was watching this movie, is that I think this movie gets at all the wild dynamics between the royal family and the media, and the way that their relationship is so tenuous. And it really depicts the royal family as kind of like completely out of touch in this bubble, because they believe, or at least the way this movie portrays the royal family to be, is that they believe themselves to be, oh, like there's all this goodwill that is banked. We're going to sort of assume that this goodwill is just going to just show up. And then you have, you know, Prince Andrew at the end of the conversation be like, well, I, this is the thing we got at earlier, which is like, he believes this interview went really well, because for a certain generation of royal, it feels like just by virtue of making yourself available, then you are doing the public a favor. How has the media's relationship with the royal family changed over the last maybe 5-10 years or so, in your view, Hannah?
I think with Prince Andrew, what is so interesting is like, is just the kind of language in which they cover it, or like kind of, you know, he's been friends with Epstein for years. These photos from 2011, the first bit of the film shows just how old these photos were. Mm-hmm. And just this way that people wouldn't touch it. People wouldn't really go there with certain things because it's the royal family. I think nowadays what you are seeing, and which I'm kind of grateful for, but there is this more, I guess there's more of an effort to actually scrutinize a bit more. And, you know, but I will say with this, I still find with this, film, it feels it's quite navel-gazing about the BBC as if it's doing the best work possible. And actually they're also part of the problem. And I found it quite distasteful how little it focused on the actual victims. You know, there was literally no voice there. And I get it. Like, there's certain angles to do it, but it was, you know, the whole point about this interview was the fact he refused to apologize. He refused to acknowledge and apologize. And that's the thing. So it's kind of, I feel there was lacking that sort of the fundamental, like Spotlight is one of the greatest.
One of the greatest journalism movies of all time.
Greatest
journalism
movies ever. Yeah. And what did that help to do? Do something significant. And you watch that film. And what I love about that film is that it's so minimal. It's such an ensemble performance. It's you know, barely anyone really raises a voice except for Mark Ruffalo in that one scene. Yeah. It's just really frustrating. But they made sure they had the voices of the victims, the victims in it. And I think that's the way to do it. So for me, like, this is, it's really going, look at us. We're changing lives here. We did that. We started a Twitter conversation. We got Prince Andrew not doing it. But it's like, okay, but what about the wider ramifications? Did you continue? Like, what was, you know, I kind of just kind of find it a little bit distasteful how much they were marginalized, the actual victims in this kind of story, in favor of, let's look how great we are at getting a scoop.
I really think that the centering of the BBC and then, as you said, the navel gazing was something that does make this movie feel a little uncomfortable. I mean, did you notice there was like no actress playing Virginia Jeffrey? Like, she was just,
They just had that one girl, right? Walking out the, which we saw her face again.
Yeah. Just with a contrast with Spotlight, Spotlight is a movie that makes, you know, great pains to make sure that you hear directly from the victims in the movie. Repeatedly, actually, to the point where, like, there are, like, very lengthy scenes where the journalists are just quiet and they are just taking notes in order to then sort of inform how that story is then later shaped. So you're right about that being a really striking thing. I do think it's worth noting that this movie, the Netflix movie, is based on a memoir by Sam McAllister, who was a producer who booked Prince Andrew. I think being the producer who booked Prince Andrew, that is enough to get you to write a memoir. That's good enough for me, you know? And so that might sort of maybe narrow the scope a little bit of how the movie ends up treating the story. Look, we got maybe like 2 minutes left here, so let's just do this kind of briefly. This is the first of two dramatizations of this Prince Andrew interview. Amazon is working on this miniseries. It's from the perspective of the BBC journalist who interviewed him. So we are going to talk about that when it comes out. But I guess my question to you guys is, very briefly, why are we so hungry for fictionalized content about the royals? Why are we so eager to use them as a lens to sort of understand this moment right now? Maybe I'll start with you, Ellie.
I think that on some level, people are telling the story because they would like to see more accountability with the royal family. This is sort of, you know, when you watch these, you're kind of like, oh, all of these things that I didn't like about the royal family, or I always suspected, or these abuses of power. Watching any little bit of content that sort of makes it look like there are consequences to actions, I think that's a big attraction of the Prince Andrew story. But also just because with the Queen, I think the Queen's death has something to do with it too, because there people maybe didn't want to do these critical. Like, we're not talking about the movie The Queen. We're talking about, you know, this movie, Scoop, and the series that's coming out. Like, looking at really bad stuff that happened with the royal family, I think we're going to see more and more fictionalized stuff, possibly even more reporting, because with the Queen gone, I think even for some royal reporters, like, it feels like you can be a little bit more It's a little bit more open season on the royal family. You can go and look at some things because no one's going to be like, oh, but we love the queen. She's the grandmother. It's like, no. Well, we need to actually look at some of these bad things.
Hannah, over to you. What is it about the royal family and the content that we want to keep creating about them? Why do we keep returning to this lens?
I think it's this feeding the beast of wanting to know a family that have historically been very guarded in their public image. They've kept a wall as much as they have these little things coming out. It's like, oh, let's humanize them. They have maintained a very clear wall between who they actually are and the public image. I think people are very keen to know. And I think art is, in a way, is kind of uses lies to tell the truth. One of my favorite quotes for like V for Vendetta. But like, that's the way. I also think, you know, they're celebrities, right? We love anything about celebrities. We want, it's all this about like knowing the unknowable. So I think it's, and as you said, Ellie, now that the Queen's dead, I think it feels a bit more like fair game to take them apart. And I'm like, go for it.
Ellie Hall, Hannah Flint, I appreciate your time. You guys are a delight. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having
me. Thank you.
Hannah Flint is a freelance TV and movie critic. She was in London. Ellie Hall is a freelance reporter who covers the royals and a whole lot more. Scoop, by the way, is out now on Netflix.
Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Alameen Abdul Mahmoud, and this is Commotion. Look, I get the sense that there are really two moods out there about artificial intelligence. There's the, whoa, look at this. This is incredible reaction. I think you saw a little bit of that when Sora came out and people were like, cool, I'll be able to make a movie on my own any day now. This is great. Or maybe when you realize that you could use ChatGPT to do the math that you don't want to do in your head anymore. And then there's also the other mood. It's the one where you just want to put your head in your hands. I'm not going to lie to you, I'm closer to that mood personally. But we are settling into all of it today because we are going to be talking about a new investigation from the New York Times. Their reporting showed that OpenAI, Google, and Meta are training their newest AI systems with data that they got from, they scraped from the internet in ways that are, let's just say, highly questionable from a copyright standpoint. The companies ignored their own corporate policies, they changed their own rules, all to just get an edge over each other in the race to create the most powerful AI model yet. Cade Metz is one of the New York Times reporters who broke the story. He's with me now from California. Cade, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Listen, I'm going to just ask you to put this in like as much regular people terms as possible. What were these three companies doing?
Well, let's just look at the big picture here. What you need to know to really understand what's going on here is that you cannot build systems like Sora, which you mentioned, or ChatGPT, or any of these generative AI systems without enormous amounts of digital data. These systems literally learn their skills by analyzing vast amounts of data culled from across the internet, more data than you and I can wrap our heads around.
Right.
And so these companies that are building these systems fundamentally have to have that data. In the case of ChatGPT, we're talking data the size of the entire internet.
Right.
Okay. And that, let that sink in. You know, all the English language text on the internet has gone into these systems.
So all the human creativity, all the sort of, you know, all the intelligence, all the reporting, all the ways that we sort of piece together stories and thoughts and opinion pieces and music, all of those things has gone into powering these systems.
And even more than that, not just Wikipedia articles and news stories and chat logs, but computer programs, databases filled with chess moves, these companies, OpenAI, the company behind ChatGPT in particular, has spent years gathering this data and curating it. And then in late 2021, they basically ran out of that data. They had used all the respectable English language text on the internet.
Yeah.
And so they said, okay, well, what do we do now? And they batted around a lot of ideas. They thought about acquiring companies that were rich in data,
right,
so they could have access to those companies' data. And then they thought, well, what if we built a speech recognition system that could then ingest podcasts and YouTube videos and audiobooks and turn that into text? And then we could feed that into these systems. And that is actually what they did.
So, like, you mentioned this, the idea of, like, acquiring companies. For a moment, Meta was sort of batting around the idea of acquiring Simon & Schuster, you know, one of the biggest sort of publishers in the world, because that would be more data for them to sort of feed the system. Like, they don't want to get into the book publishing business. They want to get into the business of, hey, those books have some information, sure be useful to teach our system stuff. And I think, like, what's useful to understand is, in the piece you quote Justine Bateman, the former actor and filmmaker who told Copyright Office that AI models were taking content, including her writing and her movies, without permission or payment. She called it, quote, the largest theft in the United States, period. Can you just put that into context for me?
Well, this is happening, you know, as you indicate, all over the place at an enormous scale. So, yeah, you know, I was talking about OpenAI. You went to Meta that then had to respond to what OpenAI was doing. OpenAI in transcribing YouTube videos with that speech recognition system they built that I mentioned, they went against YouTube terms of service.
Hmm.
You know, YouTube, which is owned by Google, says you cannot do that. You cannot build a system that automatically scrapes our videos and uses that for a new commercial service. Okay. OpenAI knew it broke the rules, but it went ahead and did it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Google then found out, or at least some employees at Google found out that OpenAI was doing this, but they were reluctant to say anything because Google was doing the same thing. They were also transcribing YouTube videos. And it's a little different with Google because it owns YouTube, but they may have been violating the copyrights of the people who posted those videos. There's a legal gray area there. We talked to a lot of lawyers who think this could they could be taken to court over this, but that's just indicative of an even larger copyright issue here. When it comes to those audio files I talked about, the video files, the text files, when you and I post that stuff to the internet, we essentially have a copyright on it.
Mm-hmm.
And OpenAI and Facebook, aka Meta, Google, they believe they have a right to use that data to build these systems. They think it's allowed under what's called fair use, an aspect of copyright law.
Right.
But that has yet to be decided. You know, many companies and individuals have sued these tech players over this, including the New York Times, by the way. My employer has sued OpenAI and Microsoft over the copyright issue. This has not been decided by the courts, has not been decided by lawmakers, and we're going to see over the coming months and years how lawmakers and judges and juries are going to decide on this.
So I got to say, you've been a journalist on this beat for 30 years. You were watching now this race to create the best AI model. You know, it's being described as an arms race, right? Your reporting describes this legal vacuum that you're getting at in terms of who is allowed to do what. The law hasn't really kept pace with the rate of technological change at all. What, if anything, can be put in place to keep these companies in check? I got maybe about a minute and a half left here.
Well, I mean, there are lots of ways this could play out. You could see companies increasingly do licensing deals with these tech giants, basically license their content. Some have already done that. Others don't want to do that. And if it goes to court and lawmakers say, you cannot use this copyrighted data in this way, it is not fair use, this technology breaks. Like, you cannot build this technology without all that copyrighted data. That is clear. And so if lawmakers crack down on that, we will not have these systems in the form that we have them today. And society writ large, the tech industry writ large, is going to have to work through that and figure out that balance that you talked about at the top of the show between the awe and the concern, right? We're constantly balancing those two things, and we're going to have to continue to balance those two things.
Kate Metz, I really appreciate your insight. Thank you so much for this. As it remains entirely obvious about the story, we are nowhere near done with it, so we will be revisiting this again. Thank you for your time, man. I really appreciate
it. Glad to do it. You're exactly right.
Kate Metz is a technology reporter for the New York Times. He also wrote a book called Genius Makers, The Mavericks Who Brought AI to Google, Facebook, and the World. That is it for the podcast. I am so invested in this conversation about AI. I just, if I could, honestly, I'd talk about it for like an hour every day. I think we're going to be revisiting this because it opens up to a lot of larger conversations about who gets to own art after it's out in the world and how much control do artists actually have over the work that they put out. But we got to leave it there for now. My name is Al-Amin Abdul Mahmoud. I'm going to be back tomorrow. I'll see you then.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.